Hello and welcome to this week's episode of What Most People Think, and I am speaking to you in the aftermath of the Aldershot pylon. So if you didn't listen to my breaking news episode, to try and drum up some extra sales for Aldershot, I counterintuitively went online and just slated Aldershot in a way that I thought was fairly tongue-in-cheek, but this prompted quite a vicious TikTok pylon at one point. But happy epilogue is that somehow it did actually shift quite a few more tickets than is usual. So it's sort of kind of worked. And I'm going to bring in Simon Evans here. Simon, first up, thanks for stepping in at short notice for the show. And also, rage bait. It turns out it's devastatingly effective. Have you ever rage baited?
No, I don't know that I have quite the clout. I don't know. You must be borderline on managing to do that, you know.
Well, no, on TikTok, nothing I'd done for a long time had done literally fucking anything, like literally embarrassingly low numbers. And then I just I managed to find the sort of Aldershot ultras. And there were a couple of semi-credible threats of violence in there. But yeah, pylons, you know, wherever they happen. And I realise we've started off by talking about online, and sometimes people moan about that, but it is a sort of weird distraction, isn't it? You're trying to be a normal person in the real world, which is what matters, and then you have to say to your wife, but fucking Dave Hammers 79 has just called me a bellend.
I was actually forced to delete Twitter from my phone recently, X from my phone, the app, and my wife said it makes such a difference to you. You're such a you're more engaged, you know, conversations, you don't arrive angry, you know, at the beginning of our face-to-face session. And I wasn't sure if it was true, but I lasted about 3 days without it. Anyway, it's just too much of a drug. Cannot quit everything at once.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, being happy is boring. You know, I think, you know, you hit a certain point in life where adrenaline is, well, it's the only time I feel alive. So therefore, yeah. It's a drug that I need to keep supping from. We've also been doing a new thing on the podcast since you were last on about piss take prices, because, yeah, basically everything is expensive and some things are piss take. So I've had a couple of people get in contact. So this has sort of like caught people's imagination. Emma contacted me to say that a jar of Kenko coffee is now £9. I mean, Kenko, that's not even Dow Egberts.
No.
Kenko, remember yourself.
That's terrible. What I do with the instant coffee, and I do, it's a bit of a sort of admission of guilt to even drink instant coffee and Hove, obviously, but I need an instant coffee to wake me up so that I can concentrate hard on making a proper coffee, you know. But I'm tempted to go and get it. I do buy the sort of catering size tin, a bit like the ones you find in a works canteen, you know. But you have to be very careful with those, because if you keep the coffee long enough, moisture gets in sooner or later and the coffee sets into a hard concrete hardcore, you know, like you might put down as a foundation for something.
Emma may have said the size of the jar, but I'm guessing by her rage it was just a normal size jar. And this one, I still can't believe that this is correct, is that, you know, the big dairy milks, right? The things that in petrol stations forever were a loss leader at about £1. Somebody sent me an image of one of them from an airport. WH Smiths are basically the worst offenders. Airport WH Smiths, £8.99 for a big dairy milk. Now, what I'm noticing here is a trend, because I went to buy a healthy shake recently at Joe and the Juice, and they can fuck off. That was £9. Do you think it's almost like a piss take of how close can we get to a tenner without sounding like a tenner?
Well, the healthy thing is, or you're absolutely, I haven't been enjoying the juice for a long time, but yeah, as soon as you put a bit of turmeric into something, you can double the price, can't you? Or so that's definitely a tell. I do notice that the airports, the big Toblerones are very expensive, but I suppose that is a quality chocolate compared to the Cadbury's, we all know, is a kind of, it's sort of chocolate. You know, I can't believe it's not chocolate, isn't it, really? And I mean, I love the stuff, you know, but it shouldn't really be in the same price as your proper Swiss gear.
Yeah, no, it's kind of like your Tetley's tea bag of chocolate, but they need to remember their position in the grand scheme of things.
Big Toblerones, though, there is a lure to those at the airport, despite the price. I can't resist it. It's like having a mag light in the in your car door, isn't it? You know, the big torch that you can use as a weapon. Like the new NYPD nightstick sort of size Toblerone. I like those.
That's where the Maglite need to do one of those subtle bits of advertising advertising. You know when a product has another use, but the manufacturer yeah. can't really allude to it? Like Rizla. Rizla, the most incredible business model, where for a very long time, it is mostly for the consumption of illegal drugs. Mostly. I mean, obviously, some people smoke roll-ups, but the king-size Rizla are really only for drug taking.
The king-size, certainly, yeah. I've never seen anyone use a king-size and just put ready rub in there.
Yeah, they and like cotton buds as well. Cotton buds, hilariously, been trying to pretend for years that people don't stick them in their ear. Do not stick in your ear. If we did that, cotton buds, you wouldn't have a fucking business. Now, coming up this week, we've had a few patrons have been asking me to talk about Ed Miliband. So remember, if you join the Patreon community, you can make demands. And yeah, I'm happy to talk about Ed Miliband this week because there's increasing pressure on him. He seems to be fighting a bit for his political life in the Labour Party, and there's an emerging story that Starmer tried to demote him at the last reshuffle, so we'll talk about that. A little bit about Zach Polanski's becoming a thing, and he wants to do a bit of eco-populism. I do think first up he's my second least favourite Polanski. And I also think that if he wants to be a Nigel Farage, he's going to need to have a signature drink. I don't want to go too route one with this, but it's peppermint tea, maybe.
I think he's looking at the turmeric Joe and the Juice, isn't he, probably? Although he'll have some kind of way of making it affordable as well, I suppose. Well, perhaps that will be a big subsidy that, you know, he can...
tax big turmeric. and we're going to, of course, talk about, my God, this story is massive and getting bigger as we talk. So it's worth saying, you know, when something's a big story where you have to timestamp when you're talking about it, we can record at 10 past 11 on Monday the 20th. The grand old Duke of Porkies, Prince Andrew himself, a lot of his shit is unraveling. That feels like a story of his life for about 20 odd years. But there's a new book out by Virginia Guthrie, and it's just getting worse for him. New revelations. So we're going to discuss that. And in the Patreon only, we're going to talk about AI. I've been watching, we're all talking about how much better the clips have got, but I'm sort of going a bit conspiracy theorist where I think they're testing the water with funny comedy clips before they use it to basically upend our way of living. New patrons, we've got three, Simon, and they get the podcast early, ad-free and with bonus content. I think next week there'll be the patron-only episode. We've got Daniel Can. His surname is spelt with two N's. Yeah, it must be weird for him when he can't do something.
Yeah, it sounds like he would wear a badge with that on his own lapel, you know.
He'd be a great US sort of senator, wouldn't he? That's the kind of Route 1 messaging. If anyone can, Daniel can. I approve this message.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm assuming that will have been told to him since he was about 6 years of age at school. He's probably a bit tired of that, but unfortunately he's stuck with it, isn't he?
Yeah, they said, no, I'd like to go on the nose. George Ponsford. George Ponsford sounds like maybe the kind of guy that's got a chain of gastro pubs and will crop up on Saturday Kitchen. He's not a Sunday brunch man. He's more of a Saturday Kitchen guy, you know, where he's done some pre-rubbed lamb or something.
I mean, you're tiptoeing around the Ponce element, aren't you, obviously, because he's a paying subscriber. But, yeah. Oh, he's Pom, is it?
Ponsford. Well, you know, like, who's the Patricia Routledge died? And we had that reminded of that great comic yes. catchphrase of it's bouquet rather than bucket. I think he definitely yeah. goes on the Ponsford rather than the Ponceford.
Maybe even Ponsford.
And we've got John Warner. John Warner, who just sounds like the old kind of benevolent millionaire owner of a northern football club. I'm just thinking of Jack Warner, used to own Blackburn
yeah,
Rovers, I think.
Which is fair enough. Jack Warner, he was the first to create the first of the sort of new wave of billionaire clubs, wasn't he, Jack Warner? Wasn't that Blackburn?
Yes, they signed, yeah, Shearer for a then club record of probably what is now the weekly wage for an apprentice at Arsenal.
Yeah, pocket change.
You are all very yeah. welcome. Domain Talking Point, our super patron, David Domain, who keeps an eye on previous week's episode. We were just having a love-in for 80s music, Simon, because I am sort of becoming very old fart these days. Just basically yeah. just said, me and Francis Foster just said, isn't 80s music great? And we were talking about Erasure and David says that Erasure is still on tour, but Francis Foster, we were talking also about how you know an 80s song within about like a second of it, like something about the production. And it was, of course, the rapid evolution of the synthesizer. 1983 saw the release of the Yamaha DX7, which was the world's first commercial digital synth, and it was more portable, reliable than the analog synths. And that kind of like, and they didn't fuck about with the sound too much. So there was a sort of like, I don't know, they just sounded, there was a machine type sound of 80s. I was listening to Ultravox recently. I don't know, was it like the most distinctive sound in musical era?
At the time, it's interesting, you look back, at the time in the 80s, music was very tribal. This is what people forget. I was into the new wave of British heavy metal and hard rock at that time, and I regarded synth music as sort of beneath my dignity to sort of notice or pay any kind of honour to. Now I look back and I think, obviously, it was fantastic, you know, and there are these AIs now, you're mentioning AI slop that's, you know, is beginning to rot our brain. But I do quite enjoy those ones where they make a video and a remix of, like, Smells Like Teen Spirit done as if it was by Erasure or you know.
Yeah, those are bizarrely good.
But yeah, it did change everything. It changed everything in hindsight. And also it changed things like film soundtracks as well, so that a lot of... I mean, somebody posted just yesterday the top 10 80s movies, and then there, you know, as done by a poll, an act called The Sting Is Back, which is a great film account. You know, he listed all of the films that didn't make the top 10 cut, and there were about 100, all of which were easily better than anything that's been released in the last 10 years, you know. And you can say we're old farts and we're just getting nostalgia, but my kids agree as well. You know, there's just a real dearth of decent stuff coming out at the moment. It's all remakes, it's all... what was the latest one? Oh, Amadeus has come out, hasn't it? Amadeus is being remade, you know, which is, I mean, obviously that's not a synth soundtrack, but you could probably do it. But they just totally ran out of ideas, you know, and it was, there was a freshness. The synth kind of music, it had a sort of spring and a bounce to it that just sort of picks your mood up.
Yeah, you could feel the hand of the creator on the films as well, whereas now there's just such a heavy corporate... a lot of films feel like they're being made by committees. Also, with me and Francis, we had a chat about the Battle of the Sexes. I'm becoming conscious on TikTok, which is a female-dominated platform, of the amount of anti-man content there. Some of it quite... sort of hateful. And I had some pushback from my patrons basically saying to me, oh, you know, stop looking at social media. You know, that's not really where the world is. But the point is, it's true. The real world is definitely always the main story, but social media is a part of the story. At the very least, it's a few chapters. And I did a bit of research, and 80% of people have a social media account in the UK. 80%, that's higher than I thought. Now, it doesn't mean that they're all duking it out on X every day about discourse and Israel and the battle of the genders, but it's just, and for young people as well, we can't ignore it. Whereas, like you say, you turned off X and you felt like a different, but they can't do that. Like their personality is bound up in the internet. You've got kids around that sort of age. How online are they, or are you actually worse?
I'm probably worse. I think I need more constant mental stimulation in a way than they do. And also they get it because, you know, my kids, they're both at various types of colleges or whatever. Matilda, my daughter, I did try and monitor her social media when she was a bit younger and stayed in the house. And I would look at her Instagram. Of course, we suspect they have a second burner account on Instagram as well. But it was actually very kind of positive. The interactions were fairly sort of manageable level, maybe a dozen a day or whatever. And they were full of, oh, you look great, babes. You know, I was always like monitoring it, make sure she wasn't getting online bullying or whatever. Edward, my son, to be honest, he's only interested in becoming a rock star, and everything he listens to is either watching band videos or merchandise, you know, and creating content to try and support that. And they don't disappear down the sort of political rabbit holes that probably I do, you know. And I am far, far more like, I mean, there is something a bit horribly tragic, isn't there, about people in their late middle age, you know, like the ones on Facebook that get confused about, you know, my granny made this, you know, crocheted this dog, you know, and can we get some love for her? And it's all AI slop. And, you know, I'm probably only minutes away from falling down into that trap now. But
do you think it's been an act of projection in a way for a generation? Because like parents spend so long on their phones, but it does seem that young people have found a way of making it more positive. But if I'm honest, myself and all the people around my age, everything, most of what we do online makes us furious. So maybe we're the ones that need to assess our relationship with it.
Absolutely. People talk about dopamine hits, but I don't think it's dopamine, is it? It's more like adrenaline. It's fight or flight, and you can't actually do either. And so you're caught endlessly in this kind of hate loop. And you're just looking for some sort of resolution to that, you know. I mean, I'm going to go totally highbrow here, but have you heard of the Tristan Cord?
I haven't, no.
In Wagner's great opera, Tristan und Isolde, which apparently changed the course of classical music in the sort of mid-19th century, it begins with an unresolved chord. I can't tell you what it is, a diminished ninth or something, but it kind of goes, it's like in a horror movie, you know, where there's a kind of a chord that you just can't resolve. And it stays unresolved until the end of the opera. About 3 hours later, it's finally resolved in a great love song. This is how I start every day, with an unresolved chord on Twitter. That, some kind of dispute or debate or conflict that I then spend the rest of the day with, just like kind of screaming cognitive dissonance in my head, and maybe gets resolved by the end of the day if you're lucky. I think, in fact, I try and go to bed with most of these chords just still clanging.
I think I've got this belief that if human beings do something repeatedly that makes them angry, the only logical conclusion is that we want to be angry.
What most people think.
The thank you and the fuck you. Thank you. I did, just coming off the back of doing 7 tour shows in 9 days.
Wow.
Wow. But the audiences have been amazing. So good. And this is like the best reviewed show I've done in terms. I don't know what it is about this show. Maybe it's some of the stuff in the second half, but the audience reaction has been a slightly different level. So I've got tour shows coming up this week. Wednesday, Milton Keynes has sold out. Stroud, the retirement home for aging hipsters. I can't help but just slag off these places. Reading as well. I mean, let's be honest, some of the most litter in Britain in the high street in Reading. I don't know what's going on there. Monmouth's fancy. And I'm back in Redditch. Alnwick up north. You have been to Alnwick? I thought it was pronounced Alnwick.
Yeah, I was there last year, actually, and to be honest, it's an absolutely lovely venue, but I struggled a little bit to bring in your crowds up there, Jeff, so if you go in hard on that one, I'll be interested to see how you go. Beautiful venue, though, very nice place.
Looking forward to it, and also Newcastle. I do have a soft spot for Newcastle. I really like the shows there. I remember once I did a tour show there, and the tour show, it had a weird start time, but it started at like 6 p.m, and that was not long after Newcastle had won at home, and they'd only won against Brighton. I mean, seriously, no offence. But fucking hell, it was like a ticker tape parade in the city. I've never seen anything like it. The energy that the gig started with was almost like, I felt like a surfer on a fucking 100-foot wave. It was incredible.
Wow.
Let's hope Brighton, let's hope Newcastle are playing at home, and let's hope they fucking win. The fuck you, Simon, over to you.
Yeah, I'm going to have a bang at my council, but I don't know whether this is universal. I only quite recently realised that we're paying about twice the council tax that every other house in our street is. And they tried to hit us. We have a house. It's arranged, not a huge house, but it's arranged. When we bought it, it was flats, and we tried to convert them, but you couldn't get permission to reincorporate the bottom, the basement, basically, as you still have to leave the house and come back in through the basement door. It's entirely our house. I am in the basement at the moment. This is where I work and stuff. But they're trying to hit us with it as if it's a second home. They're basically telling us that we have a second home and that they're therefore entitled to double the council tax. If you've got a second home now that's just unoccupied, that is just like as if it's like a country, a weekend retreat that you might pop down to in the Cotswolds or something at the weekend, they can double the council tax. And we're having to persuade them that that is not what our basement is. And we're getting to the point where Kate and I are going to have to get divorced and live separately in the two houses in order to demonstrate to them that it isn't a second home. It's quite insane. But this is, I mean, the thing is, it might sound like a little bit of a first world problem. Nice of you to have that much property. But this is actually, I think, a little window, a little canary in the coal mine. I'm literally a canary in the coal mine down in the basement, of course. But they are, just desperately trying to claw so much revenue out of every possible nook and cranny that they haven't exploited to the absolute maximum at the moment. Councils, of course, are having their grants. Their funding is being cut by government because, we're all braced for this hideous budget that's going to come along and just absolutely wind us, sandbag us in the next couple of weeks. And this is just a little foretaste of the future, I think. Everything that you've got is going to be taxed. It's a miserable regime to live in under.
Well, no, I don't think it's a first world problem. I think people listening to that will be enraged. It also is an insight into the mindset as well of just like, well, you've got stuff, fuck you kind of thing. Yeah, and I totally agree that the upcoming budget will be a bollock punch to the withering tic-tac of a bollock that the country has economically has left. Okay, we're going to talk politics now, and we're going to talk about a bit of Ed Miliband and a bit of Zach Polanski. Uh, a lot of people said to me, well, Ed Miliband's been getting off lightly in your podcast. And I do keep an eye on the Patreon comments and conversations. So I think that's a fair shout. But I sort of wanted a particularly good reason to talk about Ed Miliband. And in fairness, there's probably been a few. But it does turn out recently that in Starmer's reshuffle, he tried to push Ed Miliband, not out, but you notice he tried to demote him to housing, which is definitely a demotion from energy. And Ed Miliband's so infused about net zero and, you know, green taxes and all that sort of stuff, that housing was quite clearly a maybe you should fuck off moment, maybe go and do one. But he didn't. So the interesting thing is why maybe Starmer was like, look, there's only one adenoidal voice that's allowed in this fucking town, bitch. But he maybe thought he was trampling on his USP. I think the interesting questions that come out of there was like, one, why did he want to demote him, right? And two, why couldn't he sack him? And I deal with the second question first. I wonder how Ed Miliband won that battle. You know, is it a kind of Dominic Cummings, I know where the bodies are buried, if you do that to me, I'll quit and I'll make very life very difficult? Or is he just a bit more experienced in navigating these things?
It's a good question. To be fair, I did hear at the time, I mean, you know, like within 24 hours of the reshuffle, I remember people saying that exactly that they tried to catch on Miliband and he'd somehow kind of gone, no, I'm not going. I'm not enough of a Westminster operator to understand what bodies he might know and where they're buried. I mean, most of the obvious scandals that affected, the Labour government, or rather the Labour Party in opposition under Jeremy Corbyn, are all fairly visible. And Starmer proved himself, if nothing else, you know, to be fairly sound in terms of ridding the party of that kind of legacy, even though, of course, he is part of it himself. Ed Miliband is justifiably very unpopular for net zero, but net zero wasn't his invention, of course. Net zero was something that fucking Tories put into legislation and committed the next government to. And it is a catastrophe, arguably. You know, I don't think there's a single worse part of this government than their commitment to it and the deindustrialization that's coming from it. But unless you get in somebody who was actually equally committed to getting rid of it rather than just going to run it, I don't know that getting rid of Ed Miliband would have made very much difference. I can't remember, was it Andrew, it was my neighbour who'd left that forced the reshuffle, wasn't it?
Angela Rayner, yeah.
Angela Rayner, who resigned over her flat in a couple of blocks down south from me. I dare say she got a decent deal on her council tax. But I don't know what benefit it would create to the government, but yeah, it is weird. And Starmer, for as I say, for all the other things that I have issues with him on, he has been reasonably effective in terms of getting rid of people that he feels sort of bringing the party into disrepute. And you know, as he did eventually with Mandelson, for instance, you know, I think there's a strange disconnect there, and nobody can quite understand how he's still there. But then, obviously, you know, you look at Prince Andrew, and you as we'll be coming on to later, the ability of certain people to not understand when they've overstayed their welcome is extraordinary.
No, it is. So we're definitely going to discuss that. I mean, one of the things with Miliband is that what he's got to understand is that they sort of promised people that their bills would be £300 cheaper by the end of the Parliament, right? But the problem with public, if you make a retail political offering, what the public is £300 cheaper, right? So a lot of them would have just thought, well, it will start getting cheaper. And it hasn't. It's gone up, energy bills have gone up by about an average of 185 quid. So it's going absolutely in the opposite direction and a lot faster than the rate of reduction that was promised, right? So apparently what they might be looking at is VAT on energy bills is 5%. And so they might be taking that off. That's fucking nothing, man. That literally won't feel like that. It's a good thing to have to say, but it doesn't mean anything. I don't think that's going to take the pressure off him. And then the other pressure that he's under is that, you know, there's this find off the North Sea, Rosebank or something other. Maybe that was, am I now quoting the mum out of Citizen Kane? Rosebud? I don't know. Orson Welles' mum has been found off the in the North Sea.
No, you've lost me now. Sorry, what's been found?
So there was an oil find, but they got called in and there was the application was denied, and so there's an appeal. And so the theory goes that when the appeal comes across the desk of the energy secretary, they want someone there that's not going to say no, because we need fucking money and the unions want the jobs. So the idea was to muscle out Ed. And this isn't a new license, but obviously Labour had that blanket thing of we're not going to grant any new licenses. I mean, we do feel like the only country in the world that would have said that at this point in time. But I just feel like he's going to have to go at some point. Unpopular guy who's going to get in the way of revenue. It doesn't feel like that can last.
I mean, we're in a really bad situation now, as everyone has come to realize over the last year. You know, we thought that maybe there was a point maybe where you could just kid yourself that, you know, Labour put in the painful budget right at the start of the term, so you'd have forgotten about it by the end. But obviously, it's not patching up. By a lot of metrics, Britain is not even a rich country anymore. The idea that we're taking some sort of moral lead in the G7 by going green, and that, you know, there's going to be a couple of years of transition, but everyone's going to go, actually, Britain was quite clever there because they're now like world leaders in solar and wind and wave and sustainable bullshit. You know, we are very much, you know, putting turmeric in our coffee as we sink beneath the waves at the moment. It's, you know, we're, when you look at like the GDP per capita compared to like countries like Australia, never mind the big like world leaders in, you know, like America and China carving up all the tech future. And China, of course, I mean, there's a guy called Noah Smith, writes a blog under No Opinion. Don't know if you know him. He's like probably, it's probably the world's most popular economic subset. And he's pointed out that China are actually going to save the world in terms of, if you believe it, that solar, if you believe in the whole climate thing and don't think it's all a scam. And I, you know, still there's, you know, room for doubt on the whole thing, you know. I watched a clip the other day of a bloke saying, if there really were, if the world really was braced for climate change of the order that we're talking about, and the rising sea levels that would come as a consequence, you would start to see that filtering through in the prices for which beachfront property was changing hands. You know, you would get warnings to investors and bank loans and mortgages and so on if you were trying to build a condominium on a certain beach in Florida, you know, and there's none of it. There's absolutely nothing. There's no concern whatsoever experienced at the financial market level, which leads me to suspect that the whole thing is inflated. But even if it were, China is far more likely to be the savior of the world, because by chucking billions of tons of oil, of coal into its electrical power generator, is creating the kind of level of industrial output which is going to bring the economies of scale and make solar panels affordable. You know, that's how you go for it, you know, and that was the position that Britain was in 5 or 10 years ago, that we could be world leaders in biotech, we could be world leaders in all kinds. You know, you can actually make the units that allow people to build sustainable energy, but you cannot just run on it until it's ready. You know, we've totally put the cart before the horse, and literally nobody in the world is looking at Britain right now and going, do you know what, Britain has shown a bit of moral fibre and we need more of that in this country. We're just a laughing stock.
We are world leaders in taking a moral lead on things. See? If we can find a way of converting that into hard cash, we'll be fucking laughing.
Yeah.
What most people think.
All right, we're going to talk about Zach Polansky now. So one of the things about net zero, I've always thought, is there's just, I was all suspicious of the absolutism of it, because it just feels good to say net zero. For some reason, those two words work well together.
Like zero tolerance, isn't it? It makes you feel like you've suddenly woken up to a threat.
Yeah, it's like one of those mantras often found on the left, but increasingly on the right too, but that just are appealing, you know, trans woman is, the things that people like saying, one's safe till everyone's safe, which is just bollocks.
Love is
it's
love.
It's never true. One death is too many. Just love. It's just shut the fuck up. Like they're nuance-free phrases. And so net zero is obviously something Zach Polansky he will think Ed Miliband's not going nearly far enough. So he was asked, and this is good now, because he is an effective communicator in some ways, Zach Polansky. He's got gaining traction. He's gaining poll ratings and stuff. But he was asked, how are you going to pay for it? And he just went, wealth tax. And I just thought, that's a fucking mantra to answer a mantra. So net zero, okay, how are you going to pay for that? Wealth tax. How are you going to pay for that? None of us are safe till all of us are safe. The thing is, with wealth tax, I am not super right. I would love to have more of Elon Musk's money. I would like anybody that's got more than 10 million quid, I would love to use that money to bring down all of my costs and make my life better. It would be mental to not want that. I just don't think it's going to fucking work. That's, in many ways, it reminds me of what makes me a conservative, is that thing of seeing the world as it is, not as you wish it to be. Most people, it's almost everybody that's not super wealthy. But the question is whether or not wealth tax, when it's put to them that there's no evidence of it having worked anywhere, they just sort of brush past it. And you think, maybe you don't think it will work. Maybe that's the honest truth, is you just kind of want to do it anyway.
Well, I mean, there's different kinds of. There was a lovely quote, I think, from Rachel Reeves saying we're not going to introduce a wealth tax, but there are ways of taxing the wealthy that we're looking at. I mean, this is the way that it's being phrased, and obviously Polansky, at least to his credit, I suppose, is not attempting to cloak that wolf in sheep's clothing. It's a You know, it was the fear about democracy when it was first introduced, wasn't it, 100 years ago, when you moved to a sort of universal suffrage, that you're effectively saying, you know, it's two wolves and a lamb voting on what to have for dinner, you know, and that the attempt to just redistribute wealth will be sort of baked into it. And we've managed to resist it for a long time, but they've done it. If they do introduce it, obviously we've already seen, you know, there are loads more millionaires departing the shores of Britain. And there are going to be a huge number of voters, especially in the sort of whatever it is, the early, whether it's 16 or 18 to 25 range, who, for instance, look at the property prices around the country and especially in London right now and go, this is good. If all the millionaires leave, that will effectively have a trickle-down effect on property prices across the country, and we'll be able to afford to get on the ladder. Maybe that wouldn't be such a bad thing. People have been warning for a very long time that under the 14 years of Tory rule, if you allow property prices to remain out of reach of ordinary, hardworking, ambitious people who just want to settle down, start a family and be able to sort of have a little starter home, if you put that beyond their reach, then you will radicalize them. There's nothing more radicalizing than knowing that you're not able to buy your own home. So, you know, that will be popular, but the long-term effects will be absolutely catastrophic. That is essentially indistinguishable from the policies that destroy communism and wherever it's been tried, you know, capital flight.
But you make a compelling case. I just had this image of like Reform being the main party and the Greens being the main opposition. It's not beyond the realms of a possibility. I mean, it would be.
Well, what would happen would be it will. And I think this is what it's going to look like after the next election at the moment. It will be much more like a European style arrangement where you have to form coalitions after the vote in order to govern. And we've all seen the downsides. I mean, a lot of people have been arguing for proportional representation for a long time, knowing that that's what would happen. The great advantage of first past the post in this country traditionally is that you have to form the coalition before you go to the vote, right? So the Conservative Party is a coalition and the Labour Party is a coalition, but they all come under the same banner. And then there are Wets or there are Blue Tories or a Blue Labour or whatever. But the idea that you're going to be able to create at the moment, Reform are polling so well that they might literally just form a majority government, you know, from a standing start of four MPs, which is extraordinary. But that is the level of anger.
They'd be almost like the Bitcoin of politics, wouldn't they? That would be like a Bitcoin type rate of increment. They should make themselves a Bitcoin. In fact, you know, it feels like a word for doing a certain thing. Yeah, they went full Bitcoin. Nigel Farage. Yeah, we just went Bitcoin. Fuck it. We're going to talk about Prince Andrew now, because on Friday I was doing my Times radio show, and Fridays are now a hotspot for fucking mad shit happening in the early evening. Of course, there was the Oval Office bust up back in February when I did my second ever Times radio show and had to become a rolling fucking news anchor. And then there was another meeting on Friday with Trump and Zelensky, and all eyes were on Washington, like, fucking, this could be where the news is. I suspected it was going to pass without much incident. It would be more choreographed than before. So I'm like, right, that wasn't too much. We can do the show as it is. And then it breaks that Prince Andrew has renounced his royal title. So I had to ditch my funny jokes, and we're talking to a constitutional expert within no time at all. I always think when those stories break, by the way, there is a certain group of people that are like, fucking, they must just emerge from hibernation. It was like people that understood graphs during COVID. It's absolutely, you know, feast. So he's kind of gone, right, you know, I've had a chat with the king and we feel, and you're going, is it we or did he just tell you? We feel that maybe I should renounce some of my titles, right? So first I thought he wasn't going to be a prince anymore, but apparently that's a constitutional thing. So all the kind of Earl of fucking Wicklesworth or whatever, all that stuff's gone. Duke of York's gone. So he's just a mere Prince Andrew now. It turns out that they're trying to get out in front of stuff because there are revelations that have come out. So even after Epstein was convicted, there was an email where Prince Andrew said, basically fawning over him and said, we'll play again soon. Play. I mean, you cannot convict somebody just on the use of one word. But if I was in the jury, I'd be such a pitchfork guy. I'd go, he done it. He fucking done it. If he said play, that's too creepy. He fucking did it. Am I just being a rank populist, Simon?
A what? A rape populist?
No, a rank populist.
A rank populist. I think we're still a couple of iterations away from rape populism. Yeah.
Yeah, Jesus.
I mean, with him and Mandelson, it's like the British are the most shameless supporters. I suppose we all have those. We've probably all got mates, actual mates, who get into a bit of trouble maybe with the law and you go, don't let the buggers grind you down or whatever. You know, you'll get through this, mate. I'll be waiting for you when you get out or whatever. There is that kind of, but it's just not acceptable, is it, for a royal prince to have that kind of relationship with Epstein in the first place, you know? Mm. It is disgraceful. There is, I mean, I've said this before, but the part of me that it gets angry about this stuff is that I think Prince Andrew is obviously just not the sharpest tool in the shed. I don't know how much actual ammunition, how much, you know, how many secrets he was privy to. Hopefully the British establishment that were allowing him to be a trade envoy and so on were not equipping him with anything, you know, very much that he could do damage with. It hopefully had occurred to
keep him busy.
Exactly. Just keep him busy. I like to picture him as like Lisa Simpson with her driving wheel at the beginning, you know I'm driving the car, sure you are. But the big question remains that was still no closer to answering is, what was Epstein? You know, what was he, a construct? Was he acting on behalf of another the country's secret service? You know, a lot of people point the finger at Mossad. Was he a Mossad asset or what?
This is the big
question that needs answering, rather than was he basically an updated version of the Playboy Mansion? You know, it's obviously disgraceful. It's humiliating. It's unacceptable that, you know, anyone connected with the royal family should bring such disgrace upon us. And the new book that's come out that's demonstrated just how much he and Sarah Ferguson continue to just suck at the teat of state long after their legitimate access to it should have been.
Greedily, hungrily sucking at the teat of state. I mean, it's just that there does feel like there's a house of cards here. And from the public point of view, the whole Epstein thing does kind of like, they're all at it. You know, and I have no doubt that there are people that went to that island that probably went, fucking hell, that's a bit much. You know, like not everybody that went there was clearly a wrong one, but there's just, I think there's a decent proportion that's my view, that did bad shit. Tony Blair, he was asked about Epstein and he said, as far as I can remember, I only spent 30 minutes with him. Again, I'm going to say, as far as I can remember, that is post stag do talk. You know, when you come back, babe. We went to a strip club, but as far as I can remember, we was only in there 20 minutes. And I said to the lads, I don't know about you, I actually feel uncomfortable. It's one of those ones, isn't it? I just gave her money. I said, I don't want to dance. No, that's for college. You mentioned a book coming out. This is the posthumous book by Virginia. I can't remember. Guthrie or Guthrie? I can't remember how to say it.
I saw a bloke on Times Radio the other day, your channel, who just pronounced it Jeffrey. So I don't know if that's all right, but maybe that's okay.
This book it will be out now, and it's going to be explosive and damning. And one story that was already done in the Sunday Times was the story that Andrew tried to get information about her, which clearly seems like, right, let's find out about who is she, what she done wrong. You know, that's the inference, is that he was trying to kind of tear down her reputation. And it's a bit of a problem, considering he said he never knew who the fuck she was, right? And not only that, he fucking lied to Emily Maitlis, which you cannot do in British polite society. You just can't do that, mate.
No, although that is the point in the interview at which my loyalties are stretched to breaking point. I do feel very much a curse on both their houses at that point. And watching her own funded and sort of overseen dramatization of herself.
Two.
Well, there was one that she was behind, wasn't there? And there was another one that was independent. But
I mean, just as a journalist, though, that is apex fucking outcome. Isn't it? Where you sit down and you do an interview where everyone thinks, wow, she got him. Apparently, after that, Prince Andrew, this is like this is what entitlement really looks like, is that he didn't think it had gone that fucking bad. And I think we've all had that moment. Have you ever had that where you're at the comedy store and the open spot goes on and just dies and everyone's thinking in the group, because the green room is very tight and claustrophobic. Right, what do we do when this person gets back?
Do you know what, though? He wasn't like the open spot. This just occurred to me. But what he was like is the bloke who was a stand-up comic like in the 80s, you know, who just isn't match fit anymore. He used to close the comedy store back in the days when all you had to do was mention Thatcher and everyone would go, hey, you know. And he hasn't updated his material in 20 years. He thought he was still talking to Selena Scott, didn't he?
he would have gone Thatcher, close friend.
Yeah,
yeah, love her work. I mean, it is. You mentioned earlier in a slightly different context about these men hanging on in there, and is it always incredible to me when it's so clear that your reputation is fucked? People have worked out who you are. Surely it's got to be less exhausting and less upsetting and a strain on you to just say, "Yeah, I did some bad stuff, man. Fuck it." Like, time to take the rap. This constant running. Apparently, what he does now is he just sits in his royal residence playing video games. It's like finding out Osama bin Laden used to really like Real Housewives or whatever it was he used to fucking
watch. If I was him, I mean, the resources and the upbringing he's had, I would go out hunting as often as possible and just hope at some point you try and clear a 5-bar gate and nature takes its course, you know, and it's an honourable exit.
Or take down a few elks with you. Most people think. William, so apparently this has come from William. He's basically said to his dad, Dad, you know, like you know when your kid needs you to do something, Dad, could you fucking deal with this? Because this is going to be a night. It's going to start my reign, really. Dad, could you please, Dad? And it is a reminder of why I personally still love the royal family and always will, right? It's not because I think they're better than me. I think it's the opposite. I think that they are no better than me. That's what I love about it. So having a pervy uncle, right, or worse, that's family stuff. Divorces, affairs, pervy uncle, estranged siblings, drink problems. That is exactly what I love about the royal family. I'm not saying I like what this story is or what it's representing, but it's just a reminder, no matter how much fucking money and privilege you got, people still do stupid shit.
Yeah, I'm from a very small family, as you know, only child, mum's an only child, discovered later in life several hundred half siblings because I'm actually turned out to be a sperm donor child. Consequently, I don't really have much experience of the sort of wider, you know, the lateral, the dark sheep of the family kind of dynamic in families. I always really wanted a pervy uncle, really. That would have livened things up a little bit, you know, at Christmas.
Well, I'm not talking about any specific, you know, in that list of things I mentioned, the worst stuff doesn't apply to my family, but some of it applies to most, you know, like bigger families. And you know, it's just the other question, just finally, before we move on, this guy's got some, like, how did he have the 12 million to pay her off in 2017? The other question is, where the fuck does this guy's money come from, right? Because he's clearly not a deal maker.
Was that, I can't remember, did that not come from the Queen? I think, did she not put her hand in her pocket to find the 12 million? I think that was alleged at the time. But
his general wealth, where is it coming from?
Yeah, no, God knows he's made these business deals, these contacts, and presumably has sort of sold his time a little bit and he's trying to run it like a business. I suppose that's what you have to do he probably does corporates, doesn't he, basically? he's probably on the same rate card as us.
Maybe you should go and do the Riyadh Comedy Festival, you know, one of the guys from the 80s. For everybody else, it shortly will be the end of the episode. But me and Simon, I'm going to pick Simon's considerable brain to talk about AI slop and whether or not it's kind of like a gateway drug for even more manipulation. Okay, that is the end of the episode. Simon, always a pleasure to have you.
Thanks,
on, mate. Just in terms of stuff that I should push people towards, obviously your social channels, live dates, we need
to... Yeah, all my live dates are up on my website, The Simon Evans, and the new tour starts in January, which I'm still working and tweaking and polishing material for that, but it's called Staring at the Sun, and that's in January. I've got a few dates coming up in between now and then, headlining a few decent nights. There's one up in Yeadon in November in near Leeds, and another one.
So yeah, you got those live dates. I've been to see Simon's show at the Edinburgh Fringe. Always a brilliant tour show. And actually, it's got an AI image on the front. A very funny image of you as one of those like Star Wars figures.
That is right. I mean, part of the theme of the whole thing. That's right. It's an action figure, no to AI, dressed as a hermit, and of course, it's developed by AI. That's kind of the joke. But that is the part of the theme is, you know, the extent to which we are losing our ability to distinguish. And that strange sense I have, it's not just about AI slop online. The whole world starts to feel slightly less trustworthy to you, I think. I don't know whether that... I'm trying to work out whether that is the deterioration of the late middle-aged brain or whether it is a justifiable reaction to the endless avalanche of lies.
The Endless Avalanche of Lies feels like the follow-up. Simon, thanks for being on the show, mate. Much appreciated. And listen, thanks to all of you for listening. I love doing this podcast, man. If you think it's good, please. I think word of mouth recommendations are becoming so important. People are so overwhelmed with recommendations through pop-ups and all that shit. Please, if you think somebody you know will enjoy this podcast, then do tell them. And if there's any big breaking news this week, I don't know, that Prince Andrew is locked in the Tower of London, rest assured there will be a breaking news later in the week.